Building constituencies across disciplinary and physical boundaries can be challenging in watershed work. A project called AMD in Art, winner of the 2005 Phoenix Award for Community Involvement, successfully combined both good science and art to make a difference in Eastern Coal Country. Dr. T. Allen Comp, volunteer founder and director of the now-completed project, will discuss how he mobilized a community and a team of scientists, artists, and VISA volunteers to implement treatment systems that also serve as recreational sites, art parks, educational centers, and historical sites. Thanks to funding and expertise from many stakeholders, including the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, AmeriCorps, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Office of Surface Mining, EPA, and others, environmental and economic degradation due to acid mine drainage, or AMD, has been remediated using a multidisciplinary approach. During today's inspirational webcast, you'll learn some valuable lessons from a true leader in community-based watershed protection. So, let's meet our speaker. Today's speaker is Dr. T. Allen Comp, Director of the Appalachian Coal Country Watershed Team. Dr. T. Allen Comp has received national awards for his work with the people of the Appalachian Coal Country for a successful effort to engage the art and humanities in environmental recovery, and for his remarkable choreography of multiple federal agencies working with rural mining communities. He has been profiled by the Chicago Center for Arts Policy in its Great Arts Innovators, Great Writers series. His AMD and Art project won the EPA Phoenix Award in 2005, among other awards, and he has two EPA bronze medals. A historian of technology with a deep commitment to cultural resources, community engagement, and environmental reclamation, he is finding ways for VISTA and AmeriCorps volunteers to create a pathway to greater community engagement in the recovery of the Appalachian Coal Country. He is currently the director of the Appalachian Coal Country Watershed Team, bringing full-time VISTA staff positions to support more than 50 watershed groups in the most challenging watersheds of coal country. He is also the director of a new Western Watershed Team just starting in Colorado. So, now that I've introduced our speaker, let's get started. Alan, take it away.
Well, thank you, Megan. And I should say thank you, Megan, particularly for helping me translate what was an old slideshow into a new PowerPoint presentation that we're about to see. And I appreciate both Megan's help and all the staff at OWOW. So thanks very much. I want to tell the story of a project and its spin-off, and there are some themes within this project that I should probably sort of reveal just to make sure we all know where I'm trying to go. One of them is that the whole transformation of environmental liabilities into community assets is something that I find engaging and something that we tried to do in this project. The second is that for me, partnerships and the engagement that it comes with building those partnerships is a wonderful way to expand, to create much larger boundaries around projects and around the advocates for those projects. And you'll hear a lot about that in this presentation as well. And finally, a sort of learned commitment, if you will, is that good science is necessary, but it isn't sufficient. We really need the benefits of the dimensions that the arts and the humanities can bring to environmental reclamation. And with that as a sort of preface, let's move to slide two. This is the Appalachian Coal Country. It extends from northeastern Pennsylvania across to much of western Pennsylvania, eastern Ohio, western Maryland, almost all of West Virginia, eastern Kentucky and Tennessee, and down into central Alabama. It's the region that the OS and VISTA team that we've talked about serves, and it's the area that we were really addressing. In slide two, or three, we'll get this right. And anyway, in slide three, it's a region of amazing and remarkable resources, particularly its water resources. You can think of this region as the kind of eastern mountain spine that runs all the way down the sort of eastern half of this country. It is a vast ecosystem and one of great diversity, some of them remarkably diverse for their flora and fauna. In slide four, it's also a place where coal and iron and men and money came together to create what we call a modern industrial economy, beginning even early in the 19th century. And that coal energy base remained the largest single contributor to America's energy throughout the 19th and the first half of the 20th century. Today, even now, more than half of our energy comes from coal. So this is a place that had vital economic contributions to make to this nation. It's also, in slide five, a place of very proud places. This happens to be Johnstown, Pennsylvania, but there are cities like this built by coal and iron and people spread across all of the Appalachian coal country, and they're important places in American history. In slide six, there are also lots of small places, little coal towns or patch towns that are equally proud communities, surviving still long after coal as a major economic driver disappeared. And in these places, I think it's important to remind ourselves that the people who live in these places really practice what we preach a lot in American values about a sense of home, a sense of place, the importance of that place and that extended family to the life of a community. And I'm a native Californian. I've found this kind of commitment to place and home truly fascinating and a part of the culture that you just have to understand to be able to work there. In slide seven, there's another story to coal country as well. And that happens largely after World War II, after we sort of helped rebuild Europe and rebuild our own energy stocks. Mechanization and globalization created continuing demand for coal, but we also didn't need people to mine it much anymore. And so the lost jobs and the lost meaning that came with this severe economic and precipitous economic decline really created a deeply conflicted sense of history. There's this pride in the past and this almost shame in the present, or confusion about the present and where it's going to go next. And in slide eight, the landscape of coal country is littered with these reminders. It's an inescapable presence in the landscape to see what was and what is no longer. And even in slide nine, the water in coal country reflects this kind of stained legacy. This is acid mine drainage. What some people, scientists, for instance, would call an unstable aqueous solution, what others have called the gangrenous pus of deep earth wounds. In both cases, they're right for different reasons. But AMD is a constant. It's everywhere in coal country, more present in the northern coal fields than the southern, but orange streams are ubiquitous in coal country. And in slide 10, I often sort of get concerned about the fact that we lost in that sort of recent history and that the sort of confusion and the conflict around that history is a deeper community commitment to hard work, to community, to really nation building that is a part of coal country's real pride. And in slide 11, I think if you take it all together, the landscape, this historic legacy, the kind of overwhelming nature of coal country can really leave you bewildered about what any individual might do to try and combat or improve in that effort to recover. And I would submit in slide 12 that we're not the only creatures on the planet bewildered by that legacy, and hope that there are ways out of that. In slide 13, fortunately, there are some things that have been developed with acid mine drainage and approaches to acid mine drainage. This is a wetland created by a mine discharge that just happened to flow out on a flat place and ended up creating a wetland. About 20 years ago, scientists started to discover that the water coming out of these wetlands was actually much better in quality than the water going in. And to then look at what was going on in those wetlands that was actually creating those improvements in water quality, and then to look at how could we enhance those natural processes in creating a sort of passive treatment system that would work in dealing with these many, literally thousands of discharges across coal country. And in slide 14, you'll see a passive treatment system. these systems are being built as watershed groups and others are able to get the monitoring done and find the funding, often from my own office at the Office of Surface Mining or from state mining offices. And these systems work. This is what many of them look like, a series of rectangular ponds. The water goes in bad, it comes out good. The job is done. But for me, as an historian, and actually as a sort of public servant as well, it seems like there's also a lost opportunity here. There's $300,000 or $400,000 of public funding in something like this these days, and yet no one knows it's there. No one understands why it's important. And if we could only find ways to begin to offer that opportunity to understand and maybe the opportunity to support those efforts, it seemed like we might get a lot more done in building passive treatment systems and in sort of engaging all of the problems of coal country. But that challenge of sort of how to transform AMD treatment into constituent advocacy, into voters that want to make a difference, was something that I took as a challenge almost 15 years ago now and started looking around for places that I might find some different kinds of inspiration. And in slide 15, one of the places I looked was actually an artist I knew named Buster Simpson, who's out in Seattle. And this is an old project of Buster's. It's his River Rolades project. And he's actually carved these big limestone discs, and he's administering them to a stream that's impacted by acid rain coming off the Pacific Ocean. Buster's not a dumb guy. He understands that these tablets are not going to buffer that stream. But he had every local television station watching and filming this performance and putting it on the news. And the result was a lot more interest in that problem, a lot more public engagement in that problem. In slide 16, another sort of guy that I found very inspiring is Mel Chin, and this is his Revival Fields project. He was actually able many years ago to plant a formal garden on a Superfund site. I suspect that when Mel went to the EPA to ask to plant a garden on a Superfund site, they said, well, he's just an artist, what can he hurt? So they let him. What Mel did was to engage a lot of serious scientists in selecting plants that would really hopefully draw toxins out of the soil and actually help remediate this site. It was one of the beginnings of a whole field today called phylloremediation. But that sort of way of kind of beginning to use natural substances, plants and others, in a way that was also artful was another source of inspiration that I found really useful. And then finally, in slide 17, Peter Richards and Michael Oppenheimer, two rather amazing artists, and George Hargraves, a very well-known landscape designer, landscape architect, did this site in San Francisco Bay called Bixby Park. It's an old landfill. It had been capped. It had to meet all the rules of the landfill that's been capped. You can't irrigate. You can't penetrate the cap. You sort of can't do anything. On the other hand, they were challenged to sort of create this area or transform this area into something that was an appealing recreational opportunity. And what they did in several places around the area, this is among my favorites, is you couldn't plant a forest, but you could plant the idea of a forest and begin to let people's imagination sort of take it out from there. And it worked very well. And that sort of tricking people's imagination or encouraging people's imaginations was another thing that I find very engaging. So with that, on slide 18, I really wanted to look back at acid mine drainage and sort of think about what would happen if we redefined acid mine drainage. What if we reconceptualized it not as a science and water problem, but as a culture problem? What if we looked at it much more broadly in terms of this legacy on a whole landscape and then started approaching building something to do about that from there? Could we expand the engagement? Could we find new sources of funding if we rethought a kind of narrow approach to fixing the water? And that was what created, in slide 19, what came to be called the AMD and ART project. I will confess that I called it the ART thing for about 2 years while I poked around at an idea. But what we began to realize is that environmental problems really create a point of engagement, an entry point, if you will, for public engagement. But if you bring in new perspectives beyond science, not in addition to, but beyond, you also open up the opportunity for new partnerships, for new funding. And for me personally, I have to admit that I had the gift of 12 years of exploring an idea, almost always as a volunteer, but nevertheless as a director of a nonprofit called AMDNR that explored this idea. And we started on Flight 20 in Vintondale, Pennsylvania. In western Pennsylvania, Vintondale is a very small town, less than 600 people live there today. You'll find that for every dollar earned by the average Pennsylvanian, the average Vintondale resident earns 52 cents. You'll find the percentage of families with children living under poverty is well over 40%. You'll find that the housing stock, most of it literally dates to before 1939, and you'll find that that is typical of coal camps or patch towns all over country, thousands of communities that still survive, that struggle to survive, amidst the sort of environmental legacy of an unregulated coal industry that existed in this country up until 1977. But one important feature of this site is that thin gray line at the bottom of the hill on the right, which is a rail trail, the Ghost Town Trail. And it attracted, at the time we started to build this, an audience or a user group of about 70 or 80,000 people. That gave us an audience for this site that would never have been present otherwise. So we started to work. And in Slide 21, we worked whenever we could, however we could, so often in the rain. And we met with everyone we could find that would talk to us as we sort of kept exploring this idea. Even in this quick slide, there's a hydrogeologist, about whom I'll say more, a trail advocate who's also a power company executive, a landscape designer, and a historian manager, that's me over on the left, trying to sort of begin to poke around with this idea and working in sort of waterproof pencils on waterproof paper. In Flight 22, we also spent, thanks to Vista and AmeriCorps, I was able to get one person in the community for a long time, almost a year, before we ever held any actual community meetings. We sort of earned our trust and learned our place and the ways in which we could get to those places, so that we could then work for the community rather than bring in a team of artists and designers and historians and scientists and say, well, this is what you ought to do. My challenge to all of us as the design team was to figure out how to work for the community, to give that to give form to those community aspirations. We did hold two big design meetings. We had more than 10% of the entire population of the town in those meetings, and we came out of those meetings with multiple perspectives on this site, what the old miners thought, what the young kids thought, and everybody in between. And we built all of those into what you see on Slide 23, which is our first concept plan, actually generated by me and a landscape architect intern many years ago. But it's actually close to what we actually built as well. It turned out that the way we put things together after listening to everybody actually worked pretty well. There are three major sections in this plan. On the right is an acid mine drainage treatment system and some other stuff around that that I'll talk about. On the left is 7 acres of new wetlands fed by clean water coming out of that AMD treatment system, and a lot of stuff inside of there. And then in the lower center is an active recreation area, and I'll cover each of those in turn. In Slide 24, this is the original site, the Vinton Colliery. Opened in 1906. It was a rather progressive colliery, but there were massive stone and brick buildings across this site that were washeries and powerhouses and all the rest of that. It was really the community center. It's the colliery that created Vintondale, and it defined life in Vintondale. And I kind of began to wonder if we couldn't find a way in the environmental sort of recovery of this site to really recover that sense of community center, of community pride in that center that once existed in the early 20th century. In Slide 23, we had a long way to go. In the 1980s, this site actually in the 1950s closed. The mine closed, the buildings were salvaged, the community kind of picked up what was left after that, and it was pretty much abandoned. And that's slide 25, I hope. And by the 1980s, which is when this slide was taken, the site had become the town dump, and the town's economy was in about the same location or the same condition. However, if you'll note the roof lines in the background to those houses that are in the dead center of the building, and then look at slide 26, you'll see those same houses today looking across a new wetland that was created by the AMDNR project. We have sort of transformed a liability into an asset, created a wetland that's now contributing its part in sort of wetland life in the region. And so let me now go to those three sections of the site and give you a quick history or quick detail of each. Slide 27 will show you the upper right side of that full site plan. This is the AMD treatment system. We're dealing with somewhere between 40 and 400 gallons a minute of acid mine drainage. The pH is about 2.8. In size, some of these ponds are the size of an Olympic swimming pool. The uppermost pond is actually what we call the acid pool. It really doesn't have much to do with the treatment system, except maybe as a kind of sediment basin, but it's shallow, it's large, and it armored up with orange very quickly. It's immediately adjacent to the trail, and it's where we say, this is acid mine drainage, and here's what you can do about it. We also, along this site, planted bands of native trees, selected specifically for their fall color. So that in the fall, at the upper end where the water is the worst and the orange is the deepest, you get reds and oranges, at the grades through oranges and yellows and then into greens. It's a what we call our litmus garden. It's really an arboretum of native plants. But it's a kind of example of the way we tried to make the whole site and its full development artful. We didn't use artists as decorators. I don't really like that concept much. We tried to engage sculptors and landscape designers and historians and scientists together to sort of create this site plan in working with the community. And as one small example of how that team could work, if you note the pond shape in this slide and then go to slide 28, you'll see that the pond shapes have changed. And no one really knows on the team who actually thought of that first. What we do know is that one of us said, well, do they really have to be rectangles? And our hydrogeologist sort of scratched his head a bit and said, well, not really. And then as the manager, always looking at the budget, I said, well, what if we fit them a little better into the landscape so that the upper ends where we have to do the most excavation are narrow and the lower ends where we have to do the least excavation are wide? And he said, well, the laminar flow we need across these is perfect in that configuration. So we ended up with ponds that much better fit the landscape, and they saved us a little money, too. That kind of artful solution is something that AMDNR was rather proud of, and we sort of managed to do several times. On slide 29, when it came time to plant the litmus garden, we actually had a big weekend, almost festival, of tree planting. And what was perhaps most significant, we planted 1,500 trees, and those trees you see in the background are the size of the trees we planted. These were not seedlings. More important, we had 150 people from all over the country, many of whom were residents of Vintondale who moved away and came back to help. And I think the impact on Vintondale to see that many people come back to help was probably as important as actually planting the trees themselves. It really gave Vintondale a sense of this is a larger thing than just us, and there are people who really want to support it. Months later, in slide 30, you'll see that those trees are growing. They're actually much larger now. The ponds are beginning to fill with cattails and other vegetation. They are essentially aerobic wetlands, which is what we wanted. And we've really begun to create a transformation in this place. In slide 31, this is the wetland area, and it was always my hope that the foundations you see outlined here, the coke oven site and the machine shop and whatever else, might still exist under what had been a sort of flattened landscape of nothing but bony or waste coal. And this site was probably the most complex in many ways, the most challenging to create, and I'll go through some of that quickly. In slide 32, we had to remove between 4 and 8 feet of waste coal that had been sort of spread over the site to make it flat after you saw the slides of that dump. And that made it safe, but it also kind of erased the history from the landscape. So you can't really build wetlands on waste coal, so we needed to excavate all that. We actually found a government-financed construction contract permit process that enabled us to work with a coal hauler or coal operator to remove 70,000 tons of material for nothing. It took 6 months of us working on the permit, but it didn't cost us the $300,000 or $400,000 it would have to remove the material, and literally made the project possible by working that system. We then co-designed the wetlands with the Wildlife Habitat Council, and then had to turn to sort of, now that we've exposed all this barren kind of river clay, how do we create a wetland on top of that? And in slide 33, you'll see the result of another partnership with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers soil scientists who wanted a place to demonstrate their artificial soil. This stuff is lake dredge and cellulose, which is kind of the last thing left when you recycle paper, and biosolids and lime and a lot of other stuff, but they put 6 inches of this down across the entire site for nothing, just because we could work with them through that process. Their research is now on their own website. This was a very successful experiment, happily. But again, it kind of helped build a partnership that really opened opportunity for all of us. In slide 34, you'll see the eventual result of that. Those foundations were there. The coke oven, the 1,400-foot-long coke oven is what you see in the immediate foreground where the people are standing. We were actually able to kind of bring that history back to the surface and sort of reconnect between that proud past and a sort of site that really aims more at the future than it does at the present. So trying to build all that back into this site really was part of what we were trying to do in this history wetlands, as we now call it. In slide 35, we had the local student government actually came out and planted 10,000 native wetland species along the edge of the wetland, just to give that a jump, and had a few mud fights as well, I would offer, but we had some pretty good times. In slide 36, today, that wetland is probably among the more diverse wetland habitats in western Pennsylvania. And we were proud to see two different successful nesting pairs of wood ducks in our wetland the very first summer, which is always kind of a nice sign when you get the featured duck for Ducks Unlimited, you know, nesting in your wetland. The bat boxes you see in the center are actually working, and perhaps even more important, there are visitors, you know, people who are coming as bird watchers, as wetland science students, sort of looking at how all this is working. It really created an attraction, an asset for this community. In slide 37, back to the center, this third area, this recreational area, it wasn't even in the original concepts that the concept team had really started to work on. It was there because at those community meetings, they made it very clear they wanted active recreation. We thought, ooh, gee, do you really want to put an active recreation site next to an ethamine drainage treatment system or even a wetland? And they said, yes, and off we launched. In fact, I will confess that this recreation area is quite literally a sort of shameless assembly of community interests. There's a baseball field because the volunteer department, fire department, and others wanted a place where their kids could play Little League home games at home because they didn't have any place in Vintondale. There's a volleyball court because the high school kids wanted volleyball. There's a quiet area off to the right because moms of little kids wanted to be away from active recreation. There's horseshoes because all the geezers like me wanted to play horseshoes. And anything else that anybody wanted, and I'll confess that the soccer field's there because I said I wanted one in 1994, and we'll see that in a minute. In slide 38, the pavilion was even something that we didn't really plan on, but the community said, we really want a pavilion so we can have picnics or we can have a shelter out there when we have events. And we were like, okay, this could work. You know, we're really turning this into a community center. That's what we thought we wanted to do. Let's kind of listen to the community and keep moving. It's also a quick example of the multiple funding sources. The wood for this pavilion came from a Forest Service grant, an urban forestry grant that bought timber products for different recreational uses. The labor came from the Navy CB battalion, the construction battalion that actually built it for free. And the only thing we had to deal with was the concrete slab, which we actually got donated. So that pavilion happened because we sort of put all the pieces together to make it happen. And in 39, the soccer field is much the same way. The American Soccer Foundation donated all the equipment for this field. In 94, nobody was playing soccer in Vintondale. Today, that soccer field is actually leased by a local parochial school as their home field. And the community is realizing income from that soccer field to help maintain it and other parts of this park. In slide 40, when engagement is the goal, interpretation is really critical to that goal. And we try to make sure that this site is heavily interpreted, explained, so that people can really understand it, you know, to sort of connect to what's going on here and why is it going on. I have to say I did not stage this picture, but it's exactly what I was hoping would happen. A local mom and her kids walking the site, reading the interpretive signs, understanding how you can do something about acid mine drainage, and it doesn't have to be ugly or even boring. It can really be delightful. And it's that kind of community understanding and the consequent community support that I think building partnerships is all about. In slide 41, just to give you a quick show of what the signs look like, they're actually mounted on these concrete piers that we found on the site when we were doing the excavation and set them aside to use as a base for all the signs. They all connect you from where you are to where you could go to see other signs. So that if you get curious at all, we got you. And we can pull you into deeper understanding of the site. When there are 80,000 trail users riding past here, I only need them to sort of glance over and say, what is that? And I've got them started. And that's exactly what we want, because we want 80,000 advocates for acid mine drainage remediation and wetlands and, you know, environmental improvement. So by the time we get to slide 42, we're actually at a point where we had everything pretty much done. And we had a significant list of funding partners. We had a lot of supporters in the community. We had the site built, and we could have stopped there, but as a curious person, I kept wondering what else we might do, and it seemed to sort of get easier instead of harder as we gained more success, so we kept exploring to see what other possibilities there might be. And I want to point out, right in the center of this slide where you see that yellow curve going up, that's a ditch that existed there. And at the top of that is where Mine 6 was located. That was the big mine in Vintondale. That's where literally thousands of men went to work every day. And I'll be back to that site in a minute, but I just want you to remember that location, sort of looking out over what's now new wetland areas. So in slide 43... thinking about what else we might do, we actually submitted a Rockefeller grant to start an environmental education center, and we're able to lease for $1 a year the church that is actually the very closest building to the site and whose basement was built as a small theater. It couldn't have been a better site for us to locate into, and we found it, you know, by pure luck as much as anything else. The few members that were still surviving of that Hungarian Reformed Church were very generous in allowing us to lease that building. We maintain it, but it serves as a great place to kind of get out of the weather, to do a little classroom work, and then to get out on the site. We also went after interpretive projects in that Rockefeller grant as well, and the Heights Foundation came in to supply some of the art side of that same interpretive effort, and you'll see the beginnings of that in slide 44. This is the site that's immediately at the point where Mine 6 and that ditch that I pointed out earlier are located. We're standing on the Ghost Town Trail. The portal or the entry to Mine 6 is to our left, and this concrete slab that you see to the right is right at grade. And what we did on that site was to think about, you know, here we are with this great interpretive overlook across the history wetlands looking at the community. So what we did was to go to slide 45, and use an old 1923 Sanborn insurance maps. These maps were done for almost every industrial site in America, and they are a tremendous historical resource. We then gave that to a mosaic artist who, as you'll see in slide 46, interpreted that with us, working with her, into a 9-by-15-foot mosaic of the Sanborn insurance map. This shows all the buildings on the site, the major streets in town, the kind of best, most significant features. They're all pulled out in this mosaic that's open, you know, 24/7. It's ceramic tile out of doors. It's also surrounded by a frame that I'll talk about in a minute. But today in Site 47, you'll find the community members are constantly out there looking at some of the stuff on this frame or looking at the map sort of to see where, Mom's house was located right here at the corner of 3rd and Maple Street, to kind of reconnect with that proud past that was a significant part of Bentondale's history. And in Slide 48, just to sort of enhance that, in the frame around this mosaic, we actually use these polished tiles and then etched into them images of all the buildings that were on the site and some of the other major buildings that had been in Bentondale, some lost, some not. We also had news headlines of that were basically kind of a chronology of the community as told in the community newspaper. So the first one that you actually see on the left is something about Bentondale Mine opening. I can tell you that the last one at the far end of that line of newspaper things is a little headline about an art project starting in Bentondale. We looked at the population census and realized that between 1910 and 1920, there were 24 different languages spoken in a town of maybe 2,000 people. And so we made a little note about that in the upper left-hand corner and then translated those 24 languages, translated the word for hope into those 24 languages and put that all the way across the top of this sign. We don't have to talk about immigration. We don't have to talk about community building. We don't have to talk about diversity. We don't have to talk about companies who brought in many different groups so they couldn't talk to each other and therefore they couldn't organize. All we have to do is bring all those heritages to the surface and let people's imagination and their own memories kind of take it from there, which I find the best way to do good interpretation. In slide 49, you'll see the original portal to Mine 6, the big mine in Bentondale. There were many others, but this was the one that everybody remembers the most. In the 50s and 60s, when this site was closed, they caved in that entrance for safety reasons, and all you saw was kind of a barren hillside with a little dip in it, and that was all. So in slide 50, we reconstructed that mine portal full scale and then filled it with this polished stone. And on that polished stone, I was actually able to find some 1938 home movie footage of men changing shifts at Mine 6. And that image was then hand-etched into this 12-by-16-foot photo image almost, if you will, except it was all done by hand, that gives us this sort of ghostly image along the ghost town trail. And in slide 54, where you'll see it a little closer, there are 6 men coming out of the mine, 3 men going in, and that daily kind of dance between those who survive and those who walk into the risk was part of daily life in Bentondale, and we tried to capture that in this image in the portal that so many of them entered and some didn't come back out of, again, without saying all of that in text. In slide 52, we also had some fun. You know, we had where the water returned to the river after it had been through the treatment system in the wetlands. We held a national student competition to sort of develop some marker or something for that. I strongly recommend student competitions as a great way to get publicity. You can also select interesting people that you may or may not have met to be on the jury, and that's exactly what I did. So the upper left-hand corner is actually Buster Simpson, whose name I mentioned earlier, and there's a Harvard landscape architecture person, a garden writer, 2 wonderful Pittsburgh artists, and then a fellow former National Park Service employee who is a fellow of the American Institutes of Architects and the American Society for Landscape Architecture and a real sort of vernacular landscape godfather almost that were served as the jury for this team. They all represent different sectors that I wanted to make sure knew about the AMD and ART project, so we really used this as an opportunity, again, to create broader and broader partnerships. in slide 53, you'll actually see the winners of that project getting a couple of measurements together for themselves, because we actually built the winning proposal. One is an English major, one is a geology major, both within graduate students in landscape architecture at the University of Pennsylvania. Those projects really gave us a kind of deeper connection between this artful effort at creating an environmental reclamation project. In slide 54, I will admit that this whole process was not without its moments of concern, but there were also wonderful rewards in the process. We did win the Wetlands Award from the state of Pennsylvania. We won a Green Design Award from the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. And as has been mentioned, we won the Phoenix Award from the EPA Brownfields Program. They're sort of Oscar for it. And we were actually the first community mine-scarred lands project ever to win that award. But in 555, the best award is that other projects also kind of spin off of this one. And this is the University of Virginia in Wise, Virginia. And this lake is actually fed by a ditch you'll see in 56 that was coming off of an old strip pit and was contaminated by acid mine drainage. So the lake wasn't in very good shape either. We approached the local watershed group, approached the university about engaging me and others in a project to sort of do something about this. We brought in a wonderful student intern who developed the concept plan you'll see in slide 57. It gave us a kind of image of what we were proposing, a series of ponds along this area. And then the university agreed to become a partner with others, the watershed group, the Office of Surface Mining, the State Division of Mine, Minerals, and Energy, and others, to sort of build this thing. And today, if you remember that brick house you saw at the end of the ditch, if you look at slide 58, that's the same place, only now it's an acid mine drainage treatment system and a sort of science-rich habitat that is now an active part of the curriculum at the school and becomes a place where everyone from scientists to poets have really done student projects out there that have been quite impressive. A further stretch was in slide 59, where I had an opportunity to see how far we really might push this idea of sort of multidisciplinary approaches to watershed work. This is the Oregon coast. In slide 60, we were working on the Salmon River, and actually the first tributary on the Salmon River that's available for spawning, which is called Crowley Creek. The project in slide 61 was sponsored by the Sitka Center for Art and Ecology. It's an artist-in-residence program. And in negotiations, we sort of came up with this idea of creating a long-term intermittent residency for me. And then my task was to bring as many disciplines as I wanted, and I ended up with 16, to look at a small watershed restoration project. Each of those disciplines spent time on the land individually. Each of them had to develop a report on the values and the opportunities that they saw from their perspective. For Sitka, in slide 62, this was a chance to really look at, to look out from the studio projects into the environment and really engage this arts and ecology part of their name in a more active way with the community. And that's what we did. These 16 different disciplines, many of them were locals, a few were people that I brought in from outside as well. One of them was the same hydrogeologist that worked with us in the Andean Art Project. And when we started the project, just as a sort of early tip that this was going to be a little bit different, the local Soil and Water Conservation Service expert came out, and in slide 63, it turned out he was also amazingly good on the Indian flute. He asked to meet us there at dawn and played a blessing just to get this project started off on the right foot in that country. And it made for a wonderful beginning to what was really an amazing project. In slide 64, the fish biologist counted fish, and everybody else kind of did their thing in the watershed, and then each of them wrote their reports. The requirement was they could not write prescriptions. They had to write about values and opportunities. And we ended with a slide 65, which is a four-day meeting that we pulled together to get all of us around the table talking about what to do. And actually, on the last day of that presentation, we had already committed to and did present a final plan to the public. This project took 2 years instead of the 12 it took for AMD and ART. But the most interesting thing as a planning process was that the ending plan was actually elegantly simple. And I think primarily because all the disciplines had been there, all of them were represented at the table, and the balance that resulted from that really created a much stronger project. So today, in slide 66, that plan really has the twin strengths of the arts and the sciences on the Salmon River. And it sort of built that arts and science partnership, the partnerships with many other agencies that are active in that area, and with the community. In slide 67, back in coal country, the challenge remains everywhere to kind of build these partnerships and use all the disciplines to sort of meet the challenge of dead streams and dying communities. And it's not just acid mine drainage. In slide 68, this is the consequence of what's called straight pipes, pipes that go straight from the toilet to the creek. And those streams of untreated sewage, every time it floods, leave behind this kind of scene. And it's daunting when you think that most of these are impoverished areas where the local creek is also the local recreational opportunity. In slide 69, these problems of AMD, of straight pipes, of coal country recovery really require serious dialogue. We've got to find ways to kind of restart community conversations around what to do about the future and how to get there. Not to just complain about it forever, but to really get citizens engaged in their own, driving their own process to that kind of improvement. In slide 70, and I think we all need to stretch, we even did art exhibits like this one to sort of celebrate what most people thought was kind of embarrassing and to look at the beauty that's really often present inside what seems like a truly ugly place, and to kind of twist that around a little bit to get people to sort of think in new ways. And in slide 70, we also took time to celebrate. This is actually the parade that was held in Bentondale, Pennsylvania, when we finished this project and handed it back to the community completed. And having the fire department and all the cars and everything else out there was really a buzz. And I think we have to rethink. In slide 72, the AMD and ART staff actually helped another community nearby in Central City develop a completely different approach to a brownfields grant project that basically translated the sort of traditional brownfields concepts like you see here into slide 73, a whole watershed with the same concepts. So we use the language of brownfields to describe and identify a watershed brownfield of some 18 square miles. And we're successful in getting that grant even before mine-scarred lands were listed in the brownfields legislation. So there is, I think, real resonance in sort of beginning to rethink and reconceptualize as we try and move this forward. In slide 74, I'd also sort of urge everyone to fear not complexity. In fact, if I have comps law, it's always that the ratio of success to the level of complexity is direct. You know, there's a partnerships really are strength, no matter how confusing and frustrating they may be to develop. I also think because we really started AMD and ART after several years of sort of slow starts, we really got our big start from a big EPA grant, and that money, we didn't think of it as great, now we got our money, we can just do it. We thought of it as a chance to leverage that into larger opportunities, and that's exactly what we did with that project. I will admit in slide 75 that it still takes a lot of work, and it still takes at least one responsible adult, probably a hard-headed adult, to just drive things on occasion. But it also takes a real team. Like in slide 76, this was the team of managers that worked in Bentondale, Pennsylvania, but this in slide 77 is the team of workers that worked in Bentondale, Pennsylvania, too. And it takes both sides of that equation to make it work. It takes agencies, it takes elected officials, and it takes workers, watershed groups, that really drive the community interest in doing something about their watershed. The AMDNR team in Flight 78, and this is just 1 year of that team that happened in lots of different places, this is probably as big as it ever got. But by discipline, from left to right, there's an historian, a sculptor, a landscape designer, a hydrogeologist, that's the big guy in the middle, and three AmeriCorps members that are a historian, a biologist, and a landscape architect just out of school. By agencies, there's from left to right a federal agent person, a freelance sculptor, an academic landscape designer, Bob Deason, the hydrogeologist, who's a wonderful scientist and a patient person, is actually a partner in EarthTech, a small consulting firm near Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And again, the three AmeriCorps that were staff, and I should say that the only staff that AMDNR ever had were AmeriCorps and VISTA, and a volunteer director. So we often used to sort of laugh at ourselves because we're not supposed to call AmeriCorps and VISTA staff, and volunteer directors aren't much for directors, but we still managed to raise almost $1 million and finish a 35-acre park. Part of it is because what you see in slide 79, which is the backup team of bureaucrats that really helped make this happen. You know, this was a busload of bureaucrats that I brought out to the site to sort of see what they were helping to fund. And in this slide, there are agency people, there are academics, there are community officials. It takes all of them. And the more aware and the more engaged all of them are with each other and with the project, the better off things are. Probably the second and maybe the most, for me, rewarding spinoff in slide 80 is the Appalachian Cold Country Watershed Team. We started just a few years ago with three sites in Tennessee and five in West Virginia. Today it's 55 positions spread across eight states. And every one of these young people, and some of them aren't so young, are working individually with small volunteer watershed groups trying to clean up the mess from old coal. For me, it's a chance to sort of engage all of this kind of energy in spreading the idea of multiple partnerships, of working across disciplinary boundaries, of not getting bound up in just the science or just the history, but to really look at broader solutions and engage more people. And I would be remiss, or at least I want to take the opportunity right now in slide 84, or 81 rather, to say thank you to one of those VISTAs. This is Jenny Beckstead. She has served as the Team VISTA leader for the last 2 years. She's had the dubious distinction of having to work directly with me for the last 2 years, and she's been wonderful, and I just want to say thanks. In slide 82, for more information, there are three places to go. The Eastern Coal Region Roundtable is just what it says it is, and it's the best source for quick information about what's going on in the Appalachian Coal Country and where to get help if you're a watershed group or whatever else. The AMDNR site at .info actually includes the text for every grant we ever got, and those text links are spread throughout the website. So as you do the website tour, you'll find where we found the money to do all of those projects, and you'll have some interesting examples of at least how we wrote those grants some years ago as you start to write your own. And finally, the Appalachian Cold Country Watershed Team, ACCWT.org, which is a tremendous resource, and for anybody that knows anybody that might want to work for us, I always have to put in a commercial because we're always looking for more VISTAs. In slide 83, I think it's important to always remember that it's really about this artful engagement, the real contact between real people and real places, the opportunity of using science, using environmental reclamation or environmental projects to draw everybody in and really share with them the reason why their tax money is being well spent in projects like this. And I would submit in slide 84 that it really works almost everywhere. This is Basin, Montana, but you can also go back to Vintondale, Pennsylvania in slide 85, and the real differences in terms of community engagement and whatever else are much smaller than the geography might suggest. this idea of partnerships, this idea that the sciences are necessary but not sufficient, nor are the arts, is really one that I think spreads across the geography of this nation. In slide 86, today that project at AMD and ART is done. It was a wonderful gift to me to be able to sort of explore that idea over many years, and to sort of have a board that would let me get away with continuing to work on it as long as I could find the money, and a series of AmeriCorps and VISTA members whose talent and whose energy really lifted this project to its real success. In 87, it's now done, and we're, as I said, the website is really a catalog of ideas, of funders, of places to go, and ways to sort of approach this problem. And in slide 88, I have to tell one quick story, and that is when I went to the first public meeting in Bentondale, which you saw a slide of earlier. It was actually held in the Veterans Hall, and in Western Pennsylvania anyway, all Veterans Hall are a bar in the front and a big bingo parlor behind. And I couldn't find the door to the big room where we were holding the public meeting, so I asked one of many kind of old guys sitting at the bar, and they said, "Are you here for that art project?" And I said, "Yeah, actually, it's my idea." And you could literally hear their laughter ripple down the bar. It was kind of ha-ha, dumbest thing I've ever heard. Nobody's going to do anything with that mess over there. These sulfur creeks have been here for 50 years. Nothing good in Bentondale has happened in 50 years. And they were correct on all three points. But we went ahead with our public meeting anyway. 4 years later, this slide was taken in 1998, we're actually building picnic tables, again with that Forest Service grant, and some AmeriCorps members and some volunteers, some of them fire department members, for a park that hasn't even been built yet. Two of the guys in this picture were at the bar. And it's that capacity to build on hope that I think real engagement in environmental projects can bring to projects across this nation. Slide 89 is be ready for questions.
Thank you, Alan. Before we take questions, I do have a few more bits of information to share with you. If we could all please move to slide 90. Even though it is the summertime and many of you are going on vacation, the Watershed Academy webcast team is not going anywhere. I'd like to take a minute to let you know about our August 15th webcast. The National Environmental Education and Training Foundation, NEDIF, will discuss Eyes on the Environment, an innovative outreach project involving television meteorologists. Thanks to a partnership effort with the American Meteorological Society and others, local broadcast meteorologists from around the country are helping to raise the environmental IQ of the American public. Please join us for what promises to be a dynamic webcast presentation. Please visit the Watershed Academy webcast webpage at www.epa.gov/watershedwebcasts for more information. If you could please move to slide 91, let me draw your attention to where you can obtain Alan Comp's contact information. If you are online, simply click on the Home button at the top of your screen. You'll be returned to the seminar's homepage, which has today's email address and phone number of Alan on it. On the left-hand sidebar is a links button, which has additional resources identified for today's webcast. Also on the left-hand sidebar is the feedback button. Please take a quick minute or so to submit the online feedback form, as we really do consider your comments in our quest to improve our webcast. At this time, we will address our audience questions, beginning with those submitted online. Again, if anyone is online and would like to ask a question, please just send it in. Our first question comes from Greg in D.C., and he would like to know, was there already a great deal of concern regarding AMD in Bentondale before your leadership, or did you have to raise awareness about the issue?
Good question. Actually, the awareness of AMD and coal country in general is there. Everybody knows it's there, but everybody also knows it's been there for a long time, and they've essentially adjusted to living with it. So the level of concern about AMD is often very low It's only when you start to raise the opportunity of really doing something about it and actually demonstrate that you can do something about it, that AMD becomes, you know, lifts itself up to a level of concern rather than just awareness. I remember when I worked in an office in Altoona, Pennsylvania for a while, that the secretary in that office told me that when she was a kid, she used to think that all the creeks were filled with orange juice. And it's kind of a way of adjusting to the reality of the life one lives in coal country. So to say there was a lot of concern isn't fair, but to say there was certainly awareness of what they all call sulfur creeks, it was there, but it was, you know, sort of creating an opportunity to do something about it and creating the belief that we actually would deliver on doing something about it were the real challenges, I think, for AMD and ARC.
Our second question comes from Brandon in Virginia, and he would like to know, are there going to be similar AMD and ARC programs in other parts of the country?
Well, I hope so. I'm always ready to talk to almost anybody that wants to do an AMD and ARC-like project. That's the whole reason we put the .info website up, was to sort of provide almost a catalog of where we managed to take this project over many years. I sort of doubt that anyone would be crazy enough to try and do that all again in one place over that length of time. But I can say when we went to the University of Virginia at Wise to do that project, while AMD and ARC took almost 12 years from fumbling around to finished, the UVA WISE project literally took two, from zero to finished. And that kind of gives you a sense of how fast, how much faster you can go when you know where you're going. But I'm certainly always excited to see other kinds of projects that are adapting some of these ideas to their own landscapes and their own cultures.
Our next question comes from Ed in Southbury, Connecticut, who would like to know, what advice do you have for watersheds that are not already impacted by development, but that are at risk from future development? How can you engage citizens in a potential problem that may come from failure to act proactively?
Who's this, Ed? Ed doesn't ask easy questions. I think one of the interesting challenges or really opportunities that I would see in engaging the arts and the humanities in environmental work, particularly watershed work, is it allows, it kind of facilitates other perspectives. If you try and sort of preach to people about the potential science impacts of non-point source pollution in their watershed, it's sometimes hard to get them engaged. But if you look back over the last 100 years at how much has changed in a watershed over that period of time and begin to sort of suggest how much more could change in a much shorter period of time, you've got some more interesting information for the public. You can also begin to engage, you know, artists and writers and others in sort of thinking about ways to engage the public in these kinds of environmental projects. I actually was just talking a couple of days ago to some people in South Florida who are doing a remarkable job of engaging teachers and artists in teaching, you know, math and history and everything else across the curriculum spectrum with the arts. And it's that kind of real collaborative engagement that I think can really help address problems that seem either distant or obscure or too confusing or too sciencey for ordinary folks to understand.
And our next question comes from Patty in Virginia, who asks, what parts of Appalachia need the most AMD remediation?
Well, that's actually, the answer has to do with geology, and the simple answer is the northern coal fields are much more heavily impacted by acid mine drainage than are the southern coal fields. And that north-south line runs about through the middle of West Virginia. So in the northern coal fields, you're likely to find a lot more AMD discharges. You'll find that the AMD discharges have much lower pHs and much higher metal concentrations, and require a great deal more effort just to sort of try and address all of them. That brownfields project that we wrote the grant for in Central City is on Shade Creek, and Shade Creek may be the most polluted river in western Pennsylvania. It's only 9 miles long, and there were 21 acid mine drainage discharges in that 9 miles, three of them over 1,000 gallons a minute, one of them really high in aluminum. So you've really got to find the ways to engage all of those. But you'll find that not untypical in the northern coal fields, all the way up into Scranton, Pennsylvania, in the northeastern part of the state. Whereas as you move further south, acid mine drainage is still there, but there you see more of the problems of straight pipes and AMD, often in combination.
At this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question.
Hello.
Do you have any questions? Okay. If there are no questions over the phone, this does conclude today's Watershed Academy webcast.
It was good.
On behalf of the entire EPA Watershed Academy webcast team, I'd like to thank Dr. T. Allen Comp for presenting today.
Of course you do.
And, of course, thanks to every one of you who joined us. This is Megan Classic from the Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a great day.
Acid mine drainage, and they took one really polluted site and made it into a huge art project and revived the whole thing.